So, welcome to the first part of your second class on Britain in the 1970s. Yeah, I mentioned the last week the health minister rejecting a proposal for an anti-smoking campaign. Now, from one point of view, that's just an anecdote, you know, just something that happened. But I think that public consciousness about smoking, but more generally, government interest in public health has been a gradually rising thing. That in many ways, the welfare state is a process. Where it begins, this idea that government responsibility is wider, and government responsibility and community responsibility are come to be seen as something similar. Whereas 100 years ago, people didn't expect the government to help with public health. More important from the point of view of the general run of British political history at the time is the Suez Crisis, and there you can see this wonderful picture up there, and you can see who won in the picture.
Who won? Egypt.
Yeah, Egypt won. You can see there's the Sphinx. What has the Sphinx got in its hand? The lion's tail. Yeah, it's still the lion's tail. The lion is the British lion, and the cock is the French, and neither of them did very well. Okay, so what happened? Well, on the proposal of Harold Macmillan, Britain and France were very angry with Nasser, the president of Egypt, for a number of reasons. but unfortunately for Britain and France, Egypt controlled the Suez Canal. So the Suez Canal allows you to go from one side to the other. Your alternative route is to go round Africa. It's a long way. It's a really, really long way. And so, by an accident of geography, Egypt found itself with tremendous power. And when they were unhappy with Britain and France for other reasons, they nationalized the Suez Canal. And so Britain decided that they would go back to the old method of gunboat diplomacy, which was possible when Britain was the biggest power in the world. And they had a secret meeting in Paris with the French government and the Israeli government. And they said, listen, what we will do is the Israeli army will invade Egypt. And then France and Britain will arrive with the army to keep the peace and to stop there being a war. So, of course, this was a secret agreement. Unfortunately, you can guess the rest, the secret came out. And it is one of the... Well, it's very difficult to be proud of the role of Britain and France in this affair. A lot of people were killed. Yeah, a lot of people were killed. And Egypt won, and Nasser promptly became the hero of the entire Third World. You know, because Egypt is economically a small country. And why did Egypt win? Well, what happened was the Americans came in. The Americans wrote a letter to the British Prime Minister, and it's a wonderful letter if you ever see it. It's extremely polite. It says, oh, you know, the warmth of our relations, etc. And then it goes in to say, however, it's sad to say that I think it would be impossible for us to support you in other ways. You know, the money you asked for. If we feel that our allies are not being respected in this way, basically, you take your troops out of Egypt or you won't get any more American money. And the British took their troops out of Egypt because they gradually realized that they were no longer a superpower. Britain was no longer a superpower. And could only really intervene in a strong-arm way with American support. And when they did it without asking America, it was a disaster. Now, it's a big event for Egypt, but from the point of view of British foreign policy, it's probably mostly known for its symbolic importance. That is, it was a moment when the British elite was thinking, that's true, we're not a superpower anymore. This took quite a long time, and this probably helped with decolonization, because the British government certainly had understood by 1960 that colonialism is finished. It's just a matter of how do we organize the independence of different colonies in a way which we hope Britain will keep some influence. Yeah, of course, yeah. Hence the Commonwealth and so on. So tremendously important. One of the aims of the project of the Suez Canal was to overthrow the Egyptian president Nasser. and Britain was the loser on this one. 1956, then, to go on to another thing, is also the time of the publication of this book, The Future of Socialism by Anthony Crossland. And this is a tremendously important book. Basically, it says, class struggle is finished. Capitalist, the crisis will never come back. The problem of socialism of the future is how to distribute the plentiful goods and services which we have available. And so there's very much an absolute fruit of the post-war boom, les Trente Glorieuses, and an absolute demonstration of the fact that many people, or even most people, could not imagine it ever coming to an end. Anthony Crossland, then a very influential Labour Party person. Following year is 1957, and we see the process of colonisation continuing here. Sorry, the process of decolonisation continuing here. And you can see at the bottom right the independence of Ghana, and you can see two flags there. I'm sure you can guess which one is the flag of independent Ghana. Yeah, it's the three-coloured one with the star in the middle. And what's on the other one then? Well, you can see in the top left-hand corner, the British flag. Oh, so obviously, you know, it's quite a proprietorial sort of flag. And what else is there? GC? Say again?
No, I don't know.
Good idea, great, yeah. What is GC? GC is the name of the country before it became independent. What was it called? The Gold Coast. And it's a very symbolic name because I think it's fair to say that it represents the colonialist point of view. What is there over there? Oh, there's gold. There are people. That doesn't matter about the people. There's gold. Yeah. So it's very, very clear. And just like the Côte d'Ivoire, yeah, it's really quite a shocking way of naming people's countries. You know, it's like Rouen. What do you have in Rouen? We could name Rouen after, I don't know. Again, it's symbolic, but symbols are important. Changing from the Gold Coast to Ghana was something which. At the same time, Malaysia also became an independent state at this time. And in the 60s, there will be more and more. I am absolutely not going to give you a list of colonies that became independent in the 60s, because I think there were 160 of them. And many of them small, but you know, small is important if it's your country, you know. This is also the year then that Harold Macmillan became Conservative Prime Minister. And here you have a book about him. This is a later book about him called Super Mac. And this is a nickname that he got, Super Mac, because it was considered that everything was going well for him at this particular point. Well, the economy was flourishing. People were having better standards of living, not necessarily because of the government, but you know. And he is considered, when he won the election the following year in 58, it was considered by many commentators that he had understood the way to appeal to newly affluent workers, to workers who had more than they used to have, and, it is alleged, were more individualistic. So you get a lot of commentators saying, the workers were more individualistic in the late 50s, and Macmillan understood this, and this is why he won the election. Now, this is extremely difficult territory because, you know, it's the old story. If you ask 50 people, the first 50 people who walk around here, why did Emmanuel Macron win? You might get a lot of different answers, yeah? Because it's not so easy to know exactly why. But that's certainly an influential theory about how Macmillan won. And he's best remembered for his slogan in the 1958 election. Does anybody remember what his slogan was? He said, most of our people have never had it so good. Yeah? La plus grande partie de notre population n'a jamais vécu aussi bien. This is a nice political slogan. I don't know if it would work today. Yeah, it's not quite the same atmosphere. And the thing about it is that, as my mother says to this day, she says, and he was right. That doesn't mean it was because of Macmillan that they had it. It was certainly true that people had never lived so well. And we will see that although the crisis arrives in the 1970s, many of the improvements continue to improve. For example, of course, there are things that go very quickly. You know, unemployment can rise very quickly or fall very quickly. But for example, the quality of housing. The quality of housing is decided by government regulation, etc., and social demand. And once you have an improvement, very often the improvement gradually rises. I will be showing you the example in a moment of outside toilets. Now, toilets are always funny. People joke about toilets, but outside toilets are not that funny, in fact, if you have to live with them. And the percentage of people having outside toilets in the 1950s is falling, and it will continue falling during the 70s and during the 80s, simply because nobody was building houses with outside toilets anymore. And so even though some aspects of people's lives were getting worse, for example, unemployment, other aspects continue to get better because some reforms take a long time to work through the system. 1957, also the founding of a new organisation, the CND. Anybody? What's the CND? It's the Campaign for New Dresses, because the people were very worried about people. No, it isn't. No. It's the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, Come on. Did anybody write new dresses? Okay. I won't do this too often, I promise. It's very unfair. The Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, and there you see the symbol, which has been used for other purposes since, but in fact it is semaphore for ND, nuclear disarmament. Yeah, that's the original meaning of it. So a campaign against British nuclear weapons, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, or the CND, was an alliance of a few communists, a few Catholics, a few Quakers, religious, but mostly religious people and communists. And they said that they were against nuclear weapons in particular. They got some support from sections of the military who said that nuclear weapons have no military use. So, for example, Lord Mountbatten, who was a huge general or something like that, was against nuclear weapons because he said from a military point of view, you can't win a battle with nuclear weapons. But of course, most of them were leftists. And they organised there. You can see the first march, the second march. The first march was from London to Aldermaston. Aldermaston is the nuclear weapons research, the atomic weapons research establishment. I think it still exists. And then they marched back again the following year. Yeah, so that might not be the 1957 poster. It says something about it because the march is from London to Aldermaston. That's a long way. It's like many, many miles. And that is important politically because it means that what was most important to them was the symbolism. You have a small group of people that march a long way. You see, if you want 100,000 people, you can't organise a march of 50 miles. It's too much, yeah? So this is something which is rather typical in ways of pacifist movements or movements with a religious influence, that the important thing is the witnessing. The important thing is not to get the maximum number of people. Now, the CND was founded, but if it had stayed this small, I wouldn't have talked about it. It becomes very big over the next 5 or 6 years. And then it will again become very big in 1979, 80, 81. It have these two big waves. And for example, in the first wave, I don't know if you may have heard of the philosopher Bertrand Russell, a mathematician and philosopher Bertrand Russell, extremely famous. He was part of a demonstration when he was 95 or something, and they arrested him. I think the policeman regretted it because it was on the front page of every newspaper in the world, you know. Bertrand Russell arrested at 95 years old against nuclear weapons. So it was a political victory for Bertrand Russell.
Philosopher?
Yeah, philosopher Bertrand Russell. Philosopher, mathematician and pacifist. Yeah. What did he write? Say again?
He wrote The Eulogy of Idleness, or The Praise of Idleness.
Isn't that Paul Lafargue?
No, it's Russell.
Okay, it could be. He certainly wrote a lot of pacifist things during the First World War, but I'm afraid you can rapidly lose me. My knowledge of Russell is a little bit shaky. Okay, 1958, and it's only 12 years before the 1970s now, so many of these things, the things which are put into into action will influence the 1970s. One of the big events in 1958 was fighting between white racists and young black men at Notting Hill. Now, you've heard of Notting Hill because you've heard of the Notting Hill Carnival. But the Notting Hill Carnival was invented because of these riots afterwards as a way of bringing the community together. Yeah, so it comes from there. In fact, originally it was a mixed ethnic carnival, and then it became a Caribbean carnival a bit later. And today, of course, it's a huge thing. It's an enormous thing. So there had been racist violence in Notting Hill before, and gangs of teddy boys were known to attack black people, and in particular mixed couples, because there's nothing that terrifies racists more than mixed couples. Yeah. And this is really vicious violence. What was new in 1958 was the decision of young black men around London to come to Notting Hill to fight back. And so there was a real fight going on, and this made the front page of the national press. And you can see there the press, the Daily Mirror, which is an extremely popular, slightly left-wing newspaper. And incidentally, you need to know the most important newspapers in Britain. Yeah. If a document that they use is from the Daily Telegraph, you're supposed to know who the Daily Telegraph are. Because it's very famous, yeah, that you need supposed to know that it's a fairly serious conservative, whereas the Daily Mirror is a more popular, more left-wing. Yeah, those sorts of things, you're supposed to know those. And if you get mixed up between Time magazine and The Times, they won't like this. People do. So there you can see that the question becomes a very public question. Black versus white, what we must do. Yeah, so it's now a public question. Whereas previously it was, it wasn't. And I think I've already mentioned that certainly the everyday racism was far, far stronger than today. There's no comparison. It was tremendously common. 1958 is also the time of a radical reform of the House of Lords, which I think I've already mentioned, but in 1958, before 1958, everybody in the House of Lords was there because their father was a lord. Hereditary principle. After 1958, there was a mix. Many of them were life peers appointed by the Queen on the advice of the Prime Minister, and this is obviously more democratic than the hereditary principle because an elected government is choosing them. Now, what is interesting about that, in a way, is again what I love. What is important about history is the things that don't happen as well. And one of the things that didn't happen in the 1970s is any more reform of the House of Lords. Which is kind of surprising, because when they made the House of Lords reform in 1958, so this is just the first part, we'll do more soon. And the next one is 1999. Yeah, so they weren't in a great hurry, yeah. But it's interesting because, you know, the 1970s, you know, you had a Labour government who, in theory, were in favour of such reform, but it never got in there, yeah. Just like in the 1970s, the other thing that didn't happen was Britain didn't send troops to Vietnam to support America. Yeah, that's one of the bits about history I like, when you remember that what didn't happen can be important too. And also there we have on the bottom right, from the point of view of popular culture, the launch of two BBC classic programmes, Blue Peter and Grandstand. Now, the programmes in themselves are not that tremendously important, but they show a few things. First of all, the tremendous influence of the BBC. And secondly, the British do like programmes which last 20 years. 30 years, 40 years. Blue Peter, I think it's still on today. And Grandstand, I don't know, but it lasted for many, many years. The longest running television series in the world is? Which began in 1960 and has not finished yet. So that's something very, very English about that. And television, in any case, television will be becoming more and more important as the years go by. When I was a child, half the class had a television. And we were in the middle. We had a television in the winter. Nobody bought televisions at the time. People rented them for two reasons. First of all, they were very expensive, much more expensive than today. But also because they often broke down. You frequently needed a technician. Whereas today, normally you buy a television and it works for 7 years and then it breaks and you buy a new one. Yeah, you don't. When did you last have a television technician in your house? You know, it's not very often. Yeah. And also, my parents had this idea, you know, that in summer you should play outside and be close to nature, etc. Anyway, we did that. Right, so Blue Peter is a program for children, a very pedagogical program for children, and easy to mock. And Grandstand is the main Saturday afternoon sports program. At this time, yes. No. At this time, we have we've already had the founding of the private television. I think, yeah, the Television Act led to competition, so the BBC now has ITV as well. There are two of them, and there will be three of them in the 1970s. Yet another election. And there you have one of the posters of the Conservatives. Life's better with the Conservatives, don't let Labour ruin it. Again, you can see that we're in the post-war boom. Yeah. Again, today, I don't know if François Hollande could have got away with that slogan. It would have been a little difficult, I think. Yeah. Look at the picture. This is the ideal working-class family of the time. There are a few things that you can notice about it that are rather special. One is that he's smoking, you know. Life is wonderful, I'm smoking, you know. I think that's a television behind there. And they are around the table and eating. And although that's kind of, we don't notice it today, but this is, you know, everybody has enough to eat. That's what they're saying, you know. Because people still remember, you know, the late 30s, as the older people remember the 30s. And so I don't think you would ever put that poster today, because it's like, you know, everybody has enough to eat, yeah? It's like it's very 1950s poster.
Why do we have an election? Did
Macron
die, or?
No, he won, so he can't have died. good question. I can't remember is the answer. I can't remember why they had one. I think it was just time, because they had one in 51 and 55, 59. It was just time.
Did we have one in 57?
No. He became prime minister, replacing the previous prime minister, but not by an election. Yeah, yeah. I think it was just time. It was like every 4 years was approximate. There. And you have another conservative poster here, absolutely from the post-war boom. We are still building over 300,000 houses a year. Yeah, that's a lot. Yeah, we would love governments to build 300,000. Now, I don't think they're all public housing, but quite a lot of them are public housing. And this is also the time of the introduction of the wonderful symbol of post-war prosperity, the Mini car, the Mini, the first ever Mini. 1960 brings a few important elements here. First of all, if we stay on the left-hand side and the domestic politics or cultural history, because it's fairly it's a bit of a cliche that during the 60s and 70s too, that attitudes to sex and sexuality became more liberal. But this was very slow. This was a very slow process, and very often you can judge it by a certain number of symbolic moments, and this was one of them. Lady Chatterley's Lover, which was actually written in 1918, and is well known for having scenes of sex which are more explicit than most. And what happened was the Penguin published it, so in a paperback, a cheap paperback, and for a few days it was selling, and then somebody decided to go to the tribunal and accuse it of, was it obscenity? Obscenity, I think, yes. Yes, that's right. It was, and this became a spectacular trial for obscenity, because the law said that explicit sex is not possible unless of literary merit. And so they had a whole load of people in the tribunal trying to say, yes, it is of literary merit. No, it's not of literary merit. Penguin won. And the book sold a million copies. That was a huge number of copies.
So, but the trial was in 1960?
Yeah, the trial was in 1960, actually.
In 1918?
Oh, it was published secretly in France and smuggled in. Okay. It was not published in Britain. I'm not sure if they even tried. In the 1920s, they published a censored version. Mm-hmm. Or rather, to be precise, an expurgated version. He took out all these scenes and couldn't publish it. But what was most famous about the trial is the judge. The prosecutor spoke to the jury and said to them, "Do you believe that this is a book you would wish your wife or your servants to read?" It's a symbolic phrase, but it showed that he was imagining us everybody to be of a certain social class, because of course the vast majority of people did not have servants, and also tremendously sexist. Of course, you know, it's that men are supposed to decide what their wife reads. Now, of course, we do this, but today we have to keep it secret. Yeah, don't tell anybody anymore. On the right, then, you have the continuing decolonization, which remains, which is not over yet. I mean, it's mostly over from the point of view of political control of foreign countries, but the whole questions about racism, about immigration, about education and the place of Africa within the school curriculum, there are still 1,000 questions from colonization which are still live questions today in Britain. Here you have the political status of African states in 1960, you have different colours. Countries that the first colour at the top of the key is countries independent before 1960. The second colour is in 1960, and the last one is after. So you can see that progress is being made. But why the wind of change? Well, this is the time when Mr. Macmillan made a famous speech. The Wind of Change speech. Have you heard of this one? You've heard of this. Anybody else heard of it? Nobody could choose? Okay. Well, it was about the weather. No, it wasn't about the weather. Basically, it's a speech he gave to the white South African Parliament. It was extremely polite. He said, we love you, but if you don't give votes to black people, we can't support you. He said, more specifically, he said that African nationalism and the desire for independence is not going to go away. We, the British ruling class, have decided to take this as a fact. And you are making a mistake in trying to hold on to the old ways. And it's fairly, I mean, apart from the moral questions, it's fairly clear today that, in fact, South Africa could not last. Of course, unfortunately, many people were killed before they got freedom. But those white minorities who wanted to stick to the old, it wasn't going to happen. Yeah, they were on the wrong side of history. And it's considered to be a symbolic speech because he says, you know, basically he says all of the colonies will eventually. He doesn't say it in so many words. All of the colonies will eventually be independent. That's the meaning of it. It was not popular. Within the British Conservative Party, a number of people objected strongly to decolonisation, and the political association known as the Monday Club was founded as a direct result of Macmillan's speech to oppose him. The Monday Club later became well known for its support for the Pinochet dictatorship in Chile, and not the nicest of people. So that was a tremendously important moment because it was a conservative prime minister saying this, yeah, not nobody radical. Whereas remember, not so many years before, remember Winston Churchill, if the British Empire lasts 1,000 years, people will still say this was our finest hour beating the Nazis, yeah. And he wasn't joking. Winston Churchill really believed that, you know. I mean, 1,000 years, that sounds a lot, doesn't it? Yeah, it sounds a tremendous amount. But certainly he felt that it was a tremendously long-lasting thing. Just goes to show, doesn't it? 1960 is also another important date. It's the end of compulsory military service in the United Kingdom. So not only did I not do military service, my father didn't do military service either. Because he was... he just missed it. He just managed to avoid it. Why is that important for the 1970s? Whereas, for example, in the 1970s in France, people were still doing military service. Did you do military service, young man?
I was a conscientious objector.
Right. Okay. So you managed to avoid it, but they wanted you to do it.
I grew up in Belgium, so.
Right. Okay. 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 Fine. Yeah. They're all too young. You're too young, aren't you? Yes. Why is it important? Because so during the 70s, which is our main period that we're interested in France, Spain, Italy, and a lot of countries, the young men were all doing military service, and in Britain they were not. I think this is important, and I think that the sort of dynamism within rock music and youth culture was easier in a country where military service was no longer existing. Now, this is something which is difficult to prove. That's my opinion. But certainly, military service is something really pretty rigid, you know, and it does have a, I think it does have an important psychological effect, you know, apart from the politics of it. And so I suspect that the abolition of military service, certainly for the young men at the time who were thinking of, where were they going? Oh, no, young men like the Beatles. I think, you know, it would have been much harder for them to do that if they had to do military service in the middle. That's my opinion, anyway. Well, of course, we have the first performance of the Beatles at the Cavern Club in Liverpool. And the Beatles are important not just because, you know, they played nice music, but also because they played music in a new way. They're part of a generation who take popular music extremely seriously. The Beatles learnt to be the Beatles by performing 55 hours a week on stage in Hamburg. I mean, there's an incredible amount of work involved. Secondly, they started a real craze. Of course, everybody knows the Beatles, but out of Liverpool at the time, there were 10, 20, 30 different groups, many of whom we have forgotten. And I think that one of the reasons that Britain, as a small country, has a very good presence in popular music is just the old reason. The only way to have 10 good groups is to have 100 bad ones, in my opinion. You've got to have really an atmosphere where everybody wants to try. And I myself was a member of an extremely bad punk rock group when I was a teenager, which I am proud to say has disappeared into oblivion forever. Absolutely, yeah. I did my bit. What else about the Beatles? There are a lot of myths about the Beatles. You know, I mean, people say, you know, oh, I don't like the fabricated boys bands of today's. I like the authentic bands like the Beatles. Of course, they were completely fabricated. Yeah, their manager said, you know, no more swearing on stage, no more smoking on stage. Wear these nice jackets. Everybody looks the same. Get a nice clean haircut. I want the parents of your fans to like you. So it's very careful work. There are also excellent musicians, which that helps. But, you know, there's a lot of something going on there. And they will, in many ways, they will inaugurate the 1970s by breaking up. Yeah, they break up in 1970. And that is a symbolic break. But for British young people, that was really something, you know. You also have here, this is the time of the independence. So the Republic of South Africa became independent, as is symbolized by the coin here. And you can see that it's written in English on the right and in Afrikaans on the left. So that tells you all you need to know, really. Of course, the two languages of the white minority. Whereas today, I think they also write it in Zulu and Xhosa and a few more. I hope so. Anyway, I'm sure they do. So the Republic of South Africa became independent continued to reinforce its apartheid regime, and also a particularly horrible policy where what they did is they invented little countries in the middle of South Africa and said, the black people, that's your homeland, you live there. So all citizens of South Africa have the vote, but you're not citizens of South Africa. You are from this other land, which we have invented. That was very clever, if you could say that was very clever. And things got basically worse and worse. This is important for Britain in the 1970s because the anti-apartheid movement was one of the biggest political movements in Britain during the 1970s. Although the most important cause for the end of apartheid was, of course, the revolt of people in South Africa, nevertheless, the international movement was important, did have its importance. This is also the year when the United Kingdom became a member of the OECD, or as you say in French, the OCDE, because in French you do everything backwards. The Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, which is fundamentally a grouping of the richer countries in the world. I don't know how many members there are, but it's the most developed countries which are members of the OECD, and they produce research and negotiation about a number of different issues. 1961. Of course, 1960 was a wonderful year also because I was born. Okay, there you go. 1962. Two things going on in 1962 here. Bringing us into modernity here. First of all, at the top, you can see Coventry Cathedral. Coventry Cathedral was built. Can you see that there are two parts of it? Yeah? Now, first of all, we don't often build cathedrals in the 20th century. It's quite rare. So it's quite an event that, you know, religion was still strong enough to build a cathedral. Why are there two completely different parts to it? Anybody know this?
The part on the left was destroyed.
Yeah, absolutely. It was bombed during the war. Have you seen it?
Yes.
Oh, right, there you go. Oh, yeah, that's good. You know Coventry, that's great.
With students.
Right.
With students there.
Are you a student in Coventry? Yeah, okay. And is this part still destroyed, yeah?
She brought students.
No, I brought students
right. Oh, right, you took them to Coventry. Oh, that's good. So, why not? Yeah, why not? Yeah. I think what they decided after the war was to leave visible the effects of the bombings. I think that's the thing of it. And so it would be a symbol. So it would be a symbol of international cooperation. They did similar things in Germany. Also, 1962 is the Commonwealth Immigrants Act. The Commonwealth Immigrants Act. The Commonwealth Immigrants Act made it much more difficult for Commonwealth citizens to come to settle in the UK. Before 1962, anybody from the Commonwealth, India, Pakistan, South Africa, Kenya, could come and live in England because they wanted to. And they also had the right to vote immediately. This was the policy. Now, this is not because the British were so wonderfully welcoming. It's mainly because they didn't think many people would come, you know. But of course, transport became cheaper and cheaper, and so it became a realistic possibility for people. And so in 1962, there was the first ever law to restrict immigration from the ex-colonies. And the official title of the Act is an Act to make temporary provision for controlling the immigration into the United Kingdom of Commonwealth citizens. Notice the word temporary. It was a temporary act. They were going to, in reality, it was permanent. I don't mean that they were being hypocritical. I don't know. I don't think they knew it was going to be permanent, but in reality it was permanent. And it's today very difficult to be the first person from, if you're a millionaire, it's easy, but to be the first person of your family to move to Britain, if you're India or Pakistan or Kenya. So the big times of immigration were the 50s and the 60s, and then it got harder and harder. And most of the immigration in the 70s is families who are allowed to come. And this will be, all of the question of immigration will be tremendously important, because in the 1970s you will see the rise to political influence of younger people who were born in Britain and don't want to just be quiet. Quite often their parents were quite quiet about it because, you know, we came here, you know. And the younger generation were a bit more impatient, as is the case in many, many countries, and wanted to be able to show more presence. The Notting Hill Carnival is an example of that. In fact, there's the Notting Hill Carnival. It's not just Caribbean music. It's Caribbean music in the streets, and it's about saying it's not just because people love carnivals. It's about saying this is our home. That public festival in the streets for Caribbean music is normal. It's okay. It's good. And this is why. This is why the racists hated it, of course, not because of the music. Who cares about the music? Huh? If the ska and reggae music had not been on the streets of London, but in a park somewhere to entertain the white residents, the racists would have loved it. So it's so nice, it's so exotic. But it's the thing about a street carnival is this is our home, and that's what made it such a big thing. And that will, you know, that we'll see a lot of that in the 1970s. There are also a lot of things which we didn't understand in the 1970s, which we understand better today. And I in my list of videos, there's a series of sitcoms, and some of them today they're just obviously racist. And what's interesting, in a way, there's one called Love Thy Neighbor. And it's about a black man who lives next door to a white man, and the white man hates black people, and the black man hates white people. Today, it is just obviously racist today. At the time, it was actually written by somebody who was against racism. There's a lot of things we didn't understand. There were a lot of things we didn't understand on the idea, because it was based on the idea that, you know, sometimes silly white people don't like black people, and sometimes silly black people don't like white people. This is not how racism works. that's not what it's about. That's not what it's about. Okay, so that was an important thing. So the first one, and what's interesting about this is that the leader of the opposition, the Labour leader of the opposition, Hugh Gaitskill, denounced the law, the Commonwealth Immigrants Act. He said it was brutal anti-colour legislation. However, later on, the Labour government will introduce similar laws. It will become part of the mainstream of policy of politics to limit Commonwealth immigration. And here you have a demonstration, Coordinating Committee Against the Racist Immigration Bill. And I don't know a lot about this demonstration, but it doesn't seem to be, I don't know, I mean, maybe there were Labour Party people there, but you don't see Labour Party banners and so on. It looks like quite a small demonstration. They're probably doing what they can. 1963, then. I remember 1963. Harold Wilson became leader of the Labour Party. Oh, I have a lot of things to say about Harold Wilson. One of the best of the videos in my list is a story about the parallel careers of Harold Wilson, the Labour leader, and Edward Heath, the Conservative leader. Have you watched this one? Some of it, yeah, that's okay. It's very good. Of course, it's a documentary, and if you write a documentary about dead prime ministers, you have to make it exciting, don't you? If you imagine, you switch on the television and there's a documentary about Georges Pompidou, it's got to be interesting, or you're going to switch channels pretty quickly, aren't you? Because you don't. And so one of the difficulties with this documentary, it's a very good documentary, one of the difficulties is that they emphasise the spectacular, of course. It's television, you know, they've got to get people in. And they also emphasise the personal conflict between Harold Wilson and Edward Heath. Whereas, in fact, the personal conflict was not so important. Of course it exists, but, you know, they exaggerate it because it makes good television, yeah. So when you watch the documentaries, you have to be a little bit careful, because television is television, you know. But you get a lot of information. You learn a lot from one of the best documentaries. In any case, Harold Wilson became leader of the Labour Party. Harold Wilson was known to be a man of the people. He's smoking a pipe. At the time, this was not an elite thing to do. He was well known for wearing a cheap raincoat and driving a cheap car. He did this because he liked to do it, but also it was part of his image. When he became leader of the Labour Party, I think, the leader of the Conservative Party was Alec Douglas Home, an aristocrat. And Harold Wilson had no problems with this. You know, he would say in his speeches, he would say, you know, of course, if you want to vote for an aristocrat, well, you vote Conservative, you know. But, you know, most of us are not aristocrats. So he played the man of the people. And the Conservatives caught on to this, and I will show you this a little later. Harold Wilson, then, interesting guy, very much a pragmatist, extremely skilled at keeping the Labour Party together. Because, of course, if you're the leader of a party, you want to win elections, but if your party is seen as very divided, that makes it harder to win elections. That's just a general truth. The electorate don't like the parties. All people, oh, but I can't. You know, it makes it harder for people to vote for you. And so, apart from the questions of politics, that is, that you want to do the things that you believe in, you also, of course, it's a big priority to win elections, because if you don't win elections, you can't do the things you believe in. And so that's why normally you'll find people say, well, let's leave to one side some of the things we believe in and concentrate on this one. 1963, also a very important moment, because after many, many years of negotiation, Britain was going to join the European Economic Community, and they negotiated carefully, and then at the last moment, it really was at the last moment, somebody said no. Who was this? De Gaulle? Yeah, De Gaulle. This is a German cartoon. I worked very hard finding these images, you can see. This is the European Economic Community, or Europäische Wirtschaft, something like that. And here is John Bull, the British, waiting. This is John De Gaulle, no English people, please, yeah. The sections of the British elite were very, very angry indeed. And General De Gaulle was going to veto this again 4 years later. Why did he veto it? He suspected that England might, Britain might act too much in the in the interest of America. He saw it as a kind of, not exactly a fifth column, but a sort of influence that would mess things up because they were in America. Of course, Europe is going to be a big issue for the 1970s, but in some ways it's not too complicated. I think it's a mistake to consider the late joining of Britain to the EEC, the refusal to join the Euro, and the decision for Brexit. I think it's a mistake to consider these in psychological terms. I don't think that you can explain them by psychology. Fundamentally, Britain has more choices than France. Britain today, or 50 years ago, can emphasize its economic relations with America, or it can emphasize its relations with Europe, or it can emphasize its relations with the Commonwealth, Australia, New Zealand, but also Africa and so on. So the British elite has always had more choice, whereas like France, it's like, if you don't have Europe, there's not a big... La francophonie, ça n'a pas marché si bien que ça, finalement, au niveau économique. And so, really, the British elite just had a lot more choice going on. I think that's what's going on, which is why they're more divided. And the decision for Brexit, what was the most notable about the decisions for Brexit? It was like, what, 51%, 49%? So the most important thing is that people are really very... That is, the right were divided and the left were divided. My mother voted to leave, my auntie voted to stay. My sister voted to stay. I couldn't vote, but I wanted to leave. Yes, even my family were divided exactly down the middle on the question of the European Union. Remember also something about the difference between the European Union and the European Economic Community. The European Economic Community, I think, had 6 members at this point. Whereas today, of course, the EU is 28 members. So it's a different set of arguments also. Also, at this time in 1963, there was another report. I can't remember what the report was, about broadcasting. The government is noticing that television is getting more and more important. And so, well, what should we do about this? And they decided to give a second channel to the BBC, BBC Two. which began now in 63, and during the 1970s there will be 3 channels: BBC One, BBC Two, and ITV. ITV being a regional, a bit like FR3, that's sometimes different from region to region. That means more government influence. The BBC is not run by the government. The exact relationship between the BBC and the government has changed quite a number of times. But the BBC has influence on who will be boss. But the BBC has often done things which the government hates. You know, they're relatively independent. It's also a tremendous British success, the BBC. They export a huge number of programmes. And they're well known for the good quality of their productions, which is partly a matter of money, because if you know that you can sell to America, Australia, New Zealand, India before you translate, then you have a lot of money to make a good program. But there's also a tradition that they've built up an artistic tradition, and it's true, the BBC make good programs. I think that's a fair comment. So, and BBC Two, the intention was more educational and cultural material. So you've still got this idea that somehow government should take care, of course, of educating people in the schools, but also of educating people by radio and television. And this is the case in several countries. And if you look at much more in the radio in France, France Culture is obviously with an educational aim, you know, successful or not successful, that's a matter of opinion. And obviously Arte is a classic example, yeah, that you know, they don't make a lot of money. And they sometimes produce, although sometimes you're too tired to watch it when you get home, you know, it's like, oh, you know, I'll put on MCs, you know, it's easier. Yeah. So broadcasting and television are going to continue. In 1964, then finally, the Labour Party win a general election. So that's 5 years after the previous one, isn't it? That's 5 years after the previous one. Remember, this is still the period when the Prime Minister decides when there will be a general election. So the maximum is 5 years, but quite often after 4 years, if the government is popular, they say, well, let's do it now. Yeah. A good time, yeah. Number of things going on here. First of all, Harold Wilson now becomes Prime Minister. The Labour Party is tremendously happy. For 13 years, 51 to 64, 13 years of Conservative government. No major political party, you know, I mean, nobody likes losing elections, but when you lose them for 13 years, that's pretty depressing. And these became known in Labour mythology as the 13 wasted years. Yeah, 13 wasted years of Conservative government. You can see here one of the posters of the Labour Party. Turn out the Tories, not the tenants. Yeah, virer les conservateurs, pas les locataires, because that one of the conflicts between the Conservative and the Labour was what rights should tenants have? And this throughout the 1970s and other decades as well, this will be a constant political battle. Because some politicians think, I'm very worried about the landlords. You know, sometimes they have a problem with their tenants. Let's make a law to make things easier for the landlords. Whereas other politicians think, the main problem is the tenants. You know, they don't have enough rights. Yeah, so who should have more rights? For example, in France today, if you rent a flat, the owner of the flat cannot throw you out, except for a list of very specific reasons. For example, he wants to give it to his daughter or something like that, or sell it. Obviously, some people say, it's usually a conservative position, if it was easier for landlords to get rid of their tenants, then more landlords would rent properties, and this would mean there was less shortage. So it's a political debate about this, and this is what's going on, and will continue throughout the 70s. What rights should tenants have? What rights should landlords have? Now, the Conservatives considered that the landlords were more likely to vote Conservative, and this was probably true, and the Labour Party considered that the tenants were more likely to vote Labour, which was also probably true. Harold Wilson tried to be modern, and famously appeared in a photograph with the Beatles. The link between politicians and pop stars has always been a little bit shaky. Politicians are always a little bit careful because you never know, you know, if you're too close to pop stars. Sometimes they then say, they're very électron libre. Yeah, they can say all sorts of stuff. But it does happen from time to time. Tony Blair famously was photographed with Blur. I think it was with Blur, with Damon Albarn and Blur. This was something which Edward Heath, who will soon become a Conservative leader, really detested. He had no time for this at all. He thought it was disgusting to hang around with pop stars in this way. He was more old-fashioned gentleman sort. This is also in 1964, the Commons vote to abolish capital punishment, although actually that's not quite correct. In fact, it was the Commons vote to suspend capital punishment. However, 5 years later, they voted to abolish it, so it never came back. So there's no capital punishment in Britain after 1964. In fact, the last execution took place in 1964. 1965, very important year. And now we're really laying the political basis of the 1970s, because, you know, this is 5 years is nothing. First of all, we have a new leader of the Conservative Party, Edward Heath, also known as Ted Heath. Ted is an abbreviation for Edward. And some very unsympathetic commentator has pointed out that Ted Heath is an anagram of the death, which is not very nice of them to point out, but there you go. No, I think I'll stay sitting down. That was a good idea. What kind of person was Edward Heath? Well, he was an answer, a political answer to Harold Wilson. He didn't go to a private school. Now, this is not, you know, this sounds fairly banal today. A conservative leader who didn't go to a private school, this was a revolution. At the time, this was a revolution. He wasn't a working class lad, he was a middle class lad, but he went to a grammar school. We'll explain more about grammar schools in a moment. He went to a state school. He was from the middle classes, not from higher up in society. And many feel that he was chosen because Harold Wilson was playing the man of the people. Yeah? And so this was not the right time for the Conservative Party to choose another aristocrat as their leader. Because those are important. He wasn't very, very good with people in some ways. He was a bit of a cold fish. He was single all his life. He was never married, and he was not gay either. He just didn't seem to be interested in having relationships. That's as far as we know. And we know most things. And he will remain leader of the Conservative Party for a long time. And Harold Wilson also for a long time. And this is interesting because since then, today, you don't normally get to stay. So especially if you lose an election, you usually have to go. Yeah, at the time, Edward Heath will lose several elections and still be leader of the Conservative Party.
Strongly pro-European.
Oh yes, of course. Well, one of the most notable things about Edward Heath is he was probably he's almost the only major politician who really was a very strong European. Yeah, who believed that joining the European Economic Community was a fundamental step forward for European peace. This is partly due to his experience in the war. But certainly he was delighted to and he von Amesha he will manage to get Britain into the European Economic Community, and it may be a good if you think of purely from a psychological point of view, it may be a good thing that he died before the Brexit vote, because it would have really been very, very bad news for him. Although, of course, you can't really decide on your political alliances because of whether they make people feel bad or not. Second big event in 1965, the Race Relations Act. The Race Relations Act made it a civil offence to refuse to serve someone in a shop or business because of their colour, ethnic or national origin. That is to say that for the first time, it was illegal to refuse to serve somebody because they were black. In 1964, it was legal and common for people to say, "I don't serve people like you here, go away." And this was then, this was quite common. Now, the Race Relations Act is very, very moderate. Discrimination is a civil offence, so you can't call the police. It's not a crime. It's just a civil offence. You can go to a tribunal and sue them. You have vous pouvez les poursuivre en justice. But it's not a criminal offence. So it's very, very mild. On the other hand, to be fair on Harold Wilson and the government, it's better than anything in the rest of Europe at this time, yeah, which is not much of an excuse, but there you go.
Is it also due to the influence of the United States in the civil rights movement?
That's an interesting question. Somebody should write a thesis about that. I think it may be too early. Because the influence of the civil rights movement in Britain is after 68. Yeah, when you get movements in Britain as well, In 1965, there were anti-racist movements in Britain in the 1960s. There was the Coloured People's Movement or something, but they were very small. And they certainly were not frightening the government. No, I think what it was more about was that the government wanted... I mean, obviously, there were a lot of people in the Labour Party who hated racism. So that's something. But also, they were worried about civil unrest, yeah? That they wanted to... They wanted to be sure that there were no more riots like in Notting Hill in 1958. So there was no doubt an indirect... influence from the fact of the civil rights movement, but the whole question is posed very differently in Britain, simply because of course the people fighting for civil rights in America were not immigrants, whereas in Britain they were immigrants, and that's the one big difference between racism and anti-racism in America, is that black people in America were not immigrants, and in Britain at this time they were. This is something our first year students often forget, you know. Also the numbers involved, yeah. There were already in the 1960s, Washington was already majority black. Whole cities were the majority black. In Britain there's nothing like that. You know, there's nothing like that. I've been reading about the history of Washington recently, so I'm sure. Okay. So discrimination in the place of public resort, incitement to racial hatred, etc. So it was the first one, and it was seen at the time as being a balance, that on the one hand the government wanted to reduce the number of immigrants coming into Britain, and on the other hand they wanted to improve relations. Well, notice the name of the Act, Race Relations Act, it's not Anti-Discrimination Act or Civil Rights Act or Anti-Racism Act. It's Race Relations Act. So it's a very, very mild sort of way of looking at the world. 1966, then. Now, the most important thing that happened in 1966 was that Britain won, England won the World Cup. The football World Cup. We don't do it very often, yeah. But England won the World Cup, and I think I put on the blog some of the one of the football songs made by the English World Cup squad in 1970, because there was a tradition for a while that the football teams would sing a song, generally extremely badly. And I put an example up on the blog because it's so bad it's good, you know. It's so bad it's fun to watch. So here you have 1966, and apart from England winning the World Cup, there were also an important strike, a strike by the National Union of Seamen. Now the government, the Labour government, had introduced a new law about wage rises, to limit wage rises. Now, in the 1960s and also in the 1970s, all the governments will be very involved in wage negotiations, and the government will try to limit wage rises. Today, this does not happen in Britain. This is partly because when unemployment is high, the trade unions don't really ask for many wage rises because they can't. Yeah, but at this time, for 15 years, the government tried in different ways to control wage rises. And their argument was, if wages rise too fast, our exports are too expensive and it hurts the economy. The argument, which is not a fact, it's a theory, because other people disagree with it. And there was a strike by the National Union of Seamen. This is the dockers, yeah? The people who brought everything into Britain. At the time, there were a large number of the dockers. This is before containerization. I don't know if you know, but today, if you import tables or computers or whiteboards or bananas, they all arrive in the same size container which fits on a lorry. Everything is containerized. And so the ships, they carry containers. And they don't mind if there are bananas or fridges in them. It doesn't matter. But at the time, before containerization, it wasn't like that at all. So there were a very, very large number of seamen to carry all the bananas and fridges. That's just an example, you know. And they carry all the bananas and fridges. So it was a very big number of workers. The seamen went on strike. And Harold Wilson declared a state of emergency. L'état d'urgence. And he publicly denounced, and I quote, he said, "The people behind the strike are," I quote, a tightly knit group of politically motivated men." A tightly knit group of politically motivated men. Who is he talking about? This is a difficult one, because this is one of the difficult things about this year's agrégation question, is that you're not really people who are experienced in political history in general, and so who would you think he's talking about? He says, I'm very angry at this tightly knit group of politically motivated men. Yeah? Now, the trade unionists are not a small, tightly knit group, are they? There are 12 million.
Communists.
The Communist Party, which brings me back to something I said last year, last week, the Communist Party in Britain has never been a mass party, but they had 10,000 members or something. You know, which, in the 1960s in France, the Communist Party had a lot more than 10,000 members. even today, the Communist Party in France can organise La Fête Luma, which no other party in Europe can do. No other Communist Party in Europe can do something so big, you know, with 500,000 people. Well, in Britain, this has never been the case. But they did have some influence in the trade unions, and so that's why Harold Wilson said this. But if you look at this strike, these are the strikers, and you can see that they are carrying a poster, not Harold against the seamen, seamen against the ship owners. So you can see here the tension that although the Prime Minister, the Labour Prime Minister, had been opposed to their strike, they wanted to say, well, we're not against the governments, we're against the ship owners. And this is going to become an absolutely key question in the 1970s. Because what is new about strikes in the 1970s is that very often they will be strikes against the Labour government. Because of spending cuts or not enough wages and so on. And this will be very difficult. Remember, the trade unions founded the Labour Party. The trade unions give most of the money that the Labour Party has. And so, especially at the end of the 1970s, when there's a big wave of strikes, the so-called winter of discontent, it's very difficult for people. Except, well, it's our government, but... Yeah, but we don't want these job cuts or wage cuts. So that will become something which is new in the 1970s. Big strikes by big trade unions against a Labour government. That will be new. Okay, good luck. And here you see a Communist Party pamphlet against the policy of the Labour government, the great wage freeze trick. Yes, obviously that's a polemical title. Yeah, on se fait piéger. Par cette politique de gel des salaires. Whereas the government is saying, okay, we're freezing wages, no wage rises for 6 months, and also limits on price rises, but the government is trying to persuade people that this is a good idea because it will help the economy and so on, and, you know, it's in your interest. And the Communist Party is saying, no, we don't agree. So you can see then conflicts within the left. Now, conflicts within the left are and within the right are the normal contents of political life. And I think it's very important. Occasionally students do this. It's very important not to write things like, unfortunately, the Labour Party was divided on this question. Political debate is about people disagreeing all the time. That's normal. And necessary, and so you mustn't give this impression that, you know, that there's some sort of ideal state where the entire party agrees on everything, and unfortunately this is not the case exceptionally. In fact, all parties have permanent debate, and that's what makes them democratic parties. There was also something else going on in 1966 with Zambia, which I will be able to tell you about in just a moment, but we're just going to have 5 minutes now, just a five-minute break. And then we'll carry on. I'm glad to.